Life can grab a hold of you like captivating strings of color. It is a lesson that four women will learn as they each travel down a journey filled with lies, betrayal, and shocking secrets. Two-time number one Amazon best-selling author Marion L. Thomas brings you her riveting new book, Strings of Color. Critics call Strings of Color real and emotionally charged drama. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or order from bookstores nationwide.
Welcome to Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network, artistsfirst.com. Tony Kay in the studio. Thanks for joining us, everyone, worldwide. Questions or comments during the broadcast, always welcome. Send them to dj@artistsfirst.com. To learn more about our guest and his fascinating book, we invite you to visit our homepage where we've placed the link for Pat O'Connor and his book, Scapegoat, The Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper, published January of 2012 by Strategic Media Books and available at crimemagazine.com. Let's give a warm welcome to our guest this hour, Pat O'Connor. How do you do, sir?
Oh, good, Tony. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you for being our guest and for supporting the arts on the Artists First Network. It's a privilege to introduce you. How did you get involved in the topic that led you to write this book?
Well, in 2008, I wrote a book about a case in Philadelphia about Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's a very famous case. He was convicted of killing a police officer, and the title of my book was The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I was doing a book tour in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, and some supporters of Kevin Cooper, whom I had never heard of, came to several of my presentations and asked me to consider writing a book about Kevin Cooper's case. So that's how I first became aware of Kevin, and I went from there, and over the next 2.5 years, I did the book.
Amazing. Actually, more like a 4.5 or 5 year journey.
Well, let's see.
Yeah. 2008 to publish.
Yeah, well, I didn't really start on it until like 2009. I didn't start right away. I probably put in like 2.5-3 years on this book.
You know, it takes time for the topic to germinate in your mind and to really become committed. It's a big project.
It is. It's a serious undertaking. Just reading the, the trial transcripts run, 8,000 pages. There's thousands and thousands of appeals, and then you have all the police reports. Witness interviews. I mean, that's a ton of notating is what I do, and I read the record, and I make notes, and then I finally get to the point where I feel like I understand the case, and then that leads you to want to interview people who are connected to the case, and then you start doing that, and the book starts coming together.
You know, it's interesting how people approach a topic, a subject. Were there details that weren't in the public record that had to be solicited first before adding context, so to speak, for those records?
Well, there was a lot that the public didn't know about, that's for sure. It was in the record, but it was never really brought to the forefront. There were people who turned in information about Kevin's innocence who just got buried. Their names never were mentioned at his trial. you know, that type of thing. But when I read the when I read these police reports, I could see this. I could see these things popping up. Even though they didn't make it to the trial, I always felt that they should have. That the, see, Kevin is an indigent. He was an indigent 25-year-old criminal. His specialty was burglaries. He'd go into places, you know, homes or businesses that were unoccupied and rob them. I'm sorry to say, but his whole criminal career, he's only 25 years old, was that type of crime. Certainly nothing to do with it murdering anybody. But let me just mention how Kevin got wrapped up in this case. He was serving time on two burglary charges in Los Angeles. He was convicted in Los Angeles, and he was sent to the California Institute for Men. That's a very large prison complex in Chino, California, which is in San Bernardino County. He was there a couple of months when they classified him as minimum security. They made a mistake. He shouldn't have been minimum security because he had escaped once from a prison in Pennsylvania, and he'd walked away from a mental hospital where he was getting evaluation pre-sentencing for a burglary in Pittsburgh. So he was a high risk type of person who should have been at least minimum security, if not maximum security, because of his two past escapes. But they fouled it up. The paperwork got messed up, and he was placed in minimum security at this Chino Hills in Chino. And the very next morning after that designation, he escaped. He walked right out the prison, and made his way to a lumber yard. He hid out there for 5 hours while they're looking frantically for him. And then he doesn't know the area, but he ends up in horse country. This Chino Hills, where these murders happened, is Arabian horse capital of Southern California. And he found his way to through these horse farms, and he saw a garage door that was slightly ajar, and he opened it up and saw that nobody was in there, and he let himself into this house, and he hid out in this house for 2 days. And the Saturday night, this family was murdered 125 yards above him on a hilltop house, this poor family named the Ryan family, and a house guest. They had an 11-year-old house guest staying over that night. So the mother and the father, the daughter, and the house guest were murdered, and their little 8.5-year-old son, he was left for dead with his throat slashed and a hatchet wound to his back and his windpipe cut and all that. They thought he was dead, but he survived. So when the police found out 4 days later that Kevin Cooper, this escaped convict, had hid out in this house 125 yards below the Ryan's house, they felt like they had their man. So that's what got Kevin involved in this. Even though he had nothing to do with the actual murders, he was a convenient scapegoat for the police to make him the prime suspect.
And it's not uncommon for law enforcement to rush to the most obvious place, right? I mean, who's investigated when a woman's murdered? Well, if she's married, they go to the husband,
<That's>
or
right.
Vice versa, right?
That's right. That's quite right, and often, fittingly so.
Yeah, and so you have to wonder, and they obviously did. That were they able to trace fingerprints and other DNA or other data to the actual house from the barn residence that he had taken up in?
Well, his fingerprints were all over this vacant house, what they call the hideout house. His fingerprints were everywhere there, and that's how they found out it was Kevin who had stayed there, through fingerprints. But not one fingerprint of his was in the house where this family was murdered in their master bedroom at about midnight on a Saturday, and not one hair of a black person's was found at the crime scene, and certainly no fingerprints of Kevin's were there. They did try to come up with a thing that I thought was quite far-fetched, that far away from the master bedroom, on this little minuscule spot of blood near the baseboard of a hallway leading into the family's living room, there was this tiny drop of blood that they purported to be Kevin's, that it matched his serological profile. But that was the only thing they really had, and that was highly suspicious because it was so far from the scene of the action, and it was the only drop there. There wasn't any blood on the carpeting below it, that kind of thing. They tested, they have this thing called luminol. They can spray the carpet and see if there's other blood spots, but there weren't any. So they just had this one very curious, oddly placed drop of blood. But that was their serological link to Kevin Cooper. Now, the night of the murders, that Saturday morning, a woman, this house was occupied occasionally by a husband and wife who just used it on weekends. But anyway, this woman had returned to the house to get her sweater. And when she came through the front door, Kevin was in the bathroom. That scared him. He now knew this wasn't a safe place to continue to be, that there were people who used this house. So that night, he waited for sunset, and after 8:30, he made his way down to a highway in Chino Hills and then began hitchhiking to Mexico. And he arrived at the Tijuana border around midnight, and he didn't have a dime on him, so he slept in the bus station on the United States side of the border, and then the next day went into Tijuana itself. So, interestingly to me, what made it hard for the police to say that it was Kevin Cooper was that the little boy who survived, his name's Josh Ryan, he was airlifted to a nearby hospital in Loma Linda, California, and in the emergency room, he wasn't able to talk, but they devised this communication system of all the letters of the alphabet and the numbers 1 through 10, and the words yes and no, and he could just point to these things. And through this method, he said that his attackers were three young white men. And then that was on a Sunday afternoon. The night before, around midnight, right about the time these murders had happened, there was a couple, this is horse country, they'd come back from the racetrack, and they dropped off this trainer, and on the only road leading from the Ryan's house, this is a very remote area that they live in, this hilltop situation, only one road goes down from their house. This couple's attempting to pull out of the driveway, and they have to stop because this station wagon is hurtling down the road at a high rate of speed. So they stop and they look into the car and they see three white men. Well, when they hear about the murders the next day, they call the sheriff's office and say, we saw three white men. They didn't say young, three white men driving a station wagon. Well, it turned out that was the station wagon, that was the Ryan station wagon. Those three guys had stolen as a getaway car the Ryan station wagon. So we had the couple saying three white guys, we had the kid saying three white guys, and yet the fourth day after the murders, the sheriff of the San Bernardino County says that Kevin Cooper is the lone assailant, despite the fact that three white men have been identified by two one eyewitness, and then these two people who had no connection to anything, had no axe to grind. So they still go ahead and say that Cooper was the lone assailant. Now, what was really odd about that was this family, they were 41-year-old people. They were both chiropractors. The man was 6'2", 190 pounds, and an ex-Marine. He'd been an MP in the Marines. He knew how to take care of himself. And the mother was a very strong person. She trained Arabian horses and was very, very strong, like 5 foot 8, 150 pounds. They both kept loaded guns in the bedroom. So the notion that one person, Kevin Cooper, who weighed about 150 pounds at the time, he's 6 foot tall, but only 150 pounds, the notion that one person could control these two adults, these two really fit, able adults who have guns in their room, and kids are running around the house. The little girl even makes it outside of the house at some point during this attack, and the two boys are running around like their heads are cut off. They're so damn scared. That one person could control this family, these four or five people at once, it just didn't make any sense. It was counterintuitive that there had to be multiple people to pull off this this assault. And the people were, another thing that pointed to this was that there were three, if not four, different weapons used during the attack. There was a hatchet, and there was two kinds of knives. I believe there were two kinds. The coroner said there were two, up until it became inconvenient for him to continue to say that. Then he switched it to one knife. But he said that one knife couldn't have made these kind of cuts. It had to be two at the in the early stages of it, when before we knew we only had one suspect. And then there was an ice pick used. So you've got this, you know, this picture of, you know, if it's one person, where are all these weapons? How's he dealing with all these weapons? And these people are, all of them are hit with the hatchet, and all of them are hit with, are knifed, that type of thing. They have multiple wounds, you know, up to 35, 40 wounds a person on these victims. So, and the fact that the little girl made it outside the house during the attack, and we know that she was alive, the mother, we know that the mother was still alive when the little girl was alive because of the blood patterns on the mother and the daughter. The mother was standing at one point, dripping blood onto the mother being alive was dripping blood onto the daughter below her, and then maybe cradling her because of the blood smears on her breast. That type of thing. So anytime you had, you know, if this little girl's out of the house, then somebody would have to go out and get her. And these people are armed, as I said, and it would have been all over with. So this thing didn't make sense on a lot of levels. You know, it just didn't add up that one person could do this.
You're listening to Patrick O'Connor. He has written a fascinating book, a tragic story, Scapegoat, The Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper, available at crimemagazine.com. And when you arrive at the website, audience, go to the search this site on the left-hand column. You'll be able to put in Pat O'Connor, and you'll see the book readily, along with a write-up, available all over the World Wide Web. And, of course, as I've stated, Pat O'Connor is also the editor of Crime Magazine, which is another topic in and of itself. So thank you for supporting the arts and being my guest on Authors First. This whole project really lit a passion in you. As you began to read and study and become acquainted with the particulars of the case, a fire was lit.
Yeah, I really kind of got outraged at what I was seeing. The way that the San Bernardino County Department just really framed Kevin for this, you know, they have all the power. They really do. And they can use it or they can abuse it. And in this case, they chose to abuse it in a very reprehensible way. Let me mention one example. They could have solved this crime on the day they named Kevin as the lone assailant. A woman in 45 miles away in a town called Mentrón, she called up the sheriff's department and said there's a pair of bloody coveralls in her closet that her boyfriend, a convicted murderer, had left there the night of the Chino Hills murders. She said these coveralls are connected to the Chino Hills murders, And the reason I feel this way is that they're caked in blood, and they have Arabian horsehair on the pant legs. But from the knee down to the ankle of the pant legs, there's Arabian horsehair. So they send out a deputy sheriff who's in charge of their evidence room at this substation, and he's impressed. He calls out his supervisor, and he drives out, and they spread these coveralls out on the hood of the squad car, and they say, well, these look like, you know, they're really valuable evidence. And they bag them and take them back to the station. The deputy writes a report to the head homicide detective on the case. And the homicide detective never gets back to him. So the deputy makes a couple of phone calls over the next couple of months, never gets a return call. This report that he'd written about them said that they were heavily blood spattered, and that the woman who turned them in had additional information that she only wanted to share with homicide detectives. She didn't want to just tell a property clerk about it. She wanted homicide to call on her. Well, a few months went by, like 6 months went by. As Cooper was coming before these preliminary hearing in November 1983, the deputy, under orders from a superior of his, had the coveralls destroyed. They were thrown away. So they were never tested. I mean, they had this woman saying, these are Chino Hills related, you know, my boyfriend's a convicted murderer. He left these here in a pile on the floor, and I think they're very important in terms of this case.
But they had their man.
They had their man.
And so the facts weren't going to interrupt their conclusion.
They weren't. They weren't going to let anything get in the way. Even though they could have solved this case and been heroes, 4 days after the murders were discovered, they didn't do it.
The year is 1985.
That's the year he's convicted. The year is 1983, June the 6th, 1983.
And so over the two-year period then, before the conviction and its sentencing, all this evidence then has been swept under the carpet, just made to go away.
That's right. And there was another very important piece of evidence that nobody ever got to find out about until 2004, when it just came out inadvertently. There was a bar down the road from the Ryan's house, about a mile and a half down. Well, around midnight that night, remember the guys going down the hill in the station wagon, they drive right to this bar. These guys are like, they come in this bar, they look like they're on some kind of a, you know, like methamphetamine or something. They're spaced out. One of them puts his head down on the table, can't even lift his own head up. And they come into this bar and they order a beer. And they see, across the way, they see three pretty attractive women about in their 20s at a table. So two of these guys approach the women, and one of the women is a phlebotomist, a person who draws blood, you know, like in a doctor's office. And she says to one of these guys, she says, I hope you realize this, that you're covered in blood. You've got blood all over you. You've got blood on your face, your arms, you got it all over your clothes. And he had a very strange reaction to that. And shortly after that, those guys left. And then the next day, this would be a Sunday. This is, you know, like Saturday night at midnight, 12:30. A woman driving by the bar, she sees a blue T-shirt. So everybody in this area is, you know, where are these murders now? And so she stops her car and she goes over and looks at it. It's a bloody blue T-shirt. So she calls up the sheriff's office, and they send out a deputy, and he comes out and bags it, and the dispatcher puts it in her log that this bloody blue shirt is collected. And then the next day, this would be a Monday, because they found the blue T-shirt, the police themselves do a little investigating around the bar, and they find a tan T-shirt, a bloody tan T-shirt, on the other side of the road. So it's as though, you know, out of one side of the car, the guy threw the tan T-shirt, and then out of the other side, they threw the blue T-shirt. So because they're on opposite side of the roads, very close to this bar. Well, the blue T-shirt, this was a big problem for them because, you know, you can't expect Kevin Cooper to be wearing two bloody T-shirts. And plus, he's in prison attire. That's all the clothes he had was prison attire, and these weren't prison issued. And so they don't ever reveal the fact that there is a blue shirt. Now, in 2004, when Cooper gets a federal appeal because of his death penalty conviction, you're entitled to a federal habeas corpus appeal. The prosecution was trying to disprove some other fact connected to that bar, and they turned over logs to the Kevin's defense team, and on it referenced this blue T-shirt being collected the day before the tan T-shirt was collected. So this was a major breakthrough for Kevin's team. It should have got him a new trial because, you know, hiding evidence like this is really it's verboten. It's against the rules. The Supreme Court says, you know, that if you've got evidence that tends to exclude the person you've accused, that you are compelled to turn that over to the defense. It's called the Brady Rule, 1963 Supreme Court decision. So they had withheld this blue T-shirt all these years and then only turned it over inadvertently. So that was big. But Kevin ran into a federal judge that was hell-bent on keeping him in prison, and she refused to grant him relief on that major Brady violation, which she should have. He should have gotten a new trial right then and there. So you've got those kind of things, you know, that they throw away the coveralls, they hide the blue T-shirt. Anything that would set Kevin free, they get rid of.
Wow. We wouldn't normally think of any of our law enforcement personnel behaving in this way unless it was directed from the highest level.
Yeah, they were in kind of a funny situation there. This was by far the most infamous, notorious crime in San Bernardino County history. They had a new sheriff who had been appointed by the outgoing sheriff. He'd never run for election, and he was going to be running in about 6 or 8 months. So this case was like make or break for this new sheriff. He could either be a hero or he could be, you know, seen as incompetent. So once they got the notion, you know, once they got Kevin Cooper's fingerprints there, they put all their marbles in the bag about we've got the guy. He's our man. And then they methodically got rid of, destroyed information that would have upended their whole theory of the case.
You're listening to Authors First on the Artists First Radio Network. Tony Kaye in the studio with our guest, J. Patrick O'Connor, author of Scapegoat, The Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper, available all over the World Wide Web. It's a must-read and a story, as you can tell, our guest has a passion about. You know, in this short time that we have together, I want our audience to visit the website that we have placed on artistfirst.com, crimemagazine.com. You'll find lots of great written books on these types of forensics, criminal activity, heists, kidnapping. There's just a litany of topics available for your enjoyment. I know these cases are fascinating and the stories riveting. Thank you, J. Patrick O'Connor, for putting it together in such a succinct fashion. As you stated, just thousands and thousands of pages of documents, and beginning this process 25 years after the fact must have been laborious in the event of those who knew details that are deceased, or just finding, you know, just the memory, just trying to recall details. It has to be very difficult for you as the researcher on the project to do a succinct job. So congratulations on your perseverance.
Thank you. That's one of the biggest problems in doing a case this old, is that people have died or their memories have become foggy. You know, so I was lucky, though. I had both the public defender is still alive, and he's now retired, and the prosecutor is still alive and retired. But I was able to talk to both of them and get a lot of information from them about what happened.
And then Kevin himself.
Interviewing Kevin himself. I learned a lot about it from Kevin. I had to ask him a lot of questions he didn't want me to ask. I really had to understand his whole criminal background.
Yes.
If I was going to make any kind of case that this crime didn't fit his modus operandi, I had to understand his whole criminal background. And a lot of guys he's on death row. He's kind of been beat up enough. And for him to have to go through, you know, oh, I did this, I did that, he didn't really care much for that. But over time, I interviewed him for like 2.5 hours. And then I started doing, which was probably easier for him, I started doing written interrogatories with him, where he could take his time and not have me sitting there face-to-face, you know, making like, I wasn't accusing him of anything. I was just trying to understand him, you know, what made him tick. And was he the kind of guy who could kill children, you know, that kind of thing? Would he take an axe? Had he ever used a weapon in any of his crimes? You know, that kind of thing.
And of course, you know, he'd spent the last 25 years in prison.
He has,
while claiming his total innocence and non-involvement in any of it, and having key evidence just swept under the carpet, no way of defending himself whatsoever. And now he's no longer 25, he's 50 or 51.
He's 54 now, you know. He's 27 years in. He's spent now over half his life on death row at San Quentin.
And here you walk in, a stranger, only lit by the fire of the topic and wanting to know and probe more deeply. And so I would imagine that was a strenuous, difficult thing to do initially until that trust was created. Did you have to write some things for Kevin and show him what you were doing? Or did you strategize or talk about the lay of the land to make him feel comfortable or at ease?
Yeah, I had a couple of ground rules with him. You know, one, of course, he couldn't tell me anything that wasn't true, or I couldn't do the book. I would just have to abandon it if I found him not telling me the truth about anything, because people would hang me for this. You know, if you start taking his word and he's lying to you, then your credibility's nowhere. And I worked very closely with his appeal attorneys all through the writing of this book. They saw every draft that I wrote, every chapter, and I would tell Kevin, like a year and a half into this deal, I said, Kevin, I now know you had nothing to do with this. You're innocent.
Wow.
I didn't know this. I didn't
Powerful.
Know this the first time I saw him, but I now knew it, that he had nothing to do with it. He had no agency in it other than the fact that he'd escaped, and he had that kind of agency in it. You know, the wrong place at the wrong time.
He must have felt something when you told him that you believed him. I mean, to live your life behind bars with no one believing, and now to have someone independent follow and research and come to that conclusion must have been
That meant a lot to
him.
It really did. I just saw him about a month ago. I visited him again for a couple of hours, and he had now read the book, and he said he couldn't have been happier with the way that, you know, that there's somebody now other than him saying he's innocent.
His voice has finally been heard. even though there may be little hope of him being vindicated or his sentence commuted.
Yeah, I think so. You know, in California right now, there's a moratorium on executions, thank God. And it's been in place since 2006, or Kevin would be long dead by now. But they haven't, because of this lethal injection protocol that they use, this so-called three-drug cocktail, and they don't have any medical people who are willing to administer it, so it's done by guards. And it's been shown enough, in many other states as well, that these guards are not competent to administer a three-drug cocktail. They'll give you too little or too much of one thing, and the thing they're particularly bad at giving you is the sedative that knocks you out. And then these other drugs come in, you know, one paralyzes your, one stops your breathing, the other stops your heart from beating. They come on, and you're not sedated enough that it's excruciating pain. And I know you'll remember this name, Kenneth Starr, the attorney that prosecuted Bill Clinton during the, you know, the
yes, that's,
you know,
right.
What was the name, you know, the woman's name, you know, whatever, during that scandal back in 1996 or so, 97. Anyway, that attorney, he's the one who helped get the moratorium in California because he was able to show that the three-drug cocktail administration is frequently botched and causes excruciating pain to the person, and so it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. So Kenneth Starr got this thing. He took this case, and they won. And this federal judge suspended executions in California until such time that they could develop protocol that would be effective. Well, they haven't been able to do it. And they won't be able to do it until, they won't even try to do it until next year, 2013. They may make another run at it, but it'll be challenged. It'll be challenged, too. And so in that sense, Kevin's been kept alive on a technicality, and that's all good. That's all good for him. The law firm that represents him is about the biggest law firm in San Francisco. It's called ORRICK, O-R-R-I-C-K. They have offices worldwide. I mean, you name the capital in Europe or Asia, they have offices there. This is a humongous law firm of 1,300 attorneys. Well, they have two attorneys that pro bono have worked on Kevin's appeals. And right now they've hired a former FBI agent to reinvestigate the case. They're trying to come up with new information that would prove Kevin's innocence. You know, they're trying to go back and, you know, through this FBI agent and maybe talk to some of the investigators, the detectives at the time, and find out why they hung this on Cooper. You know, how they did it, why they did it, you know, that kind of thing. If he could come up with anything like that, then Kevin could get a new day in court.
Now, a lie detector test at this point can't be done.
Well, they're not admissible. That's the problem, Tony. They're not admissible in court. Kevin was never even offered a lie detector test. He would have gladly taken one. You know, when you're innocent, you're very happy to take lie detector tests. But when you're innocent, they don't give you lie detector tests.
Well, in this case, they were convinced from the beginning, and that was going to be the end.
They had their man.
Politically motivated, power motivated, resource motivated, whatever the case may be, in 1983 to 85, they were intent on covering up evidence. Do you think that there still may be evidence out there? I mean, it's not uncommon today to find people that have been on death row, where new evidence has surfaced that would say, hey, it couldn't have been him because here's DNA over here that proves that someone else was in the room.
Yeah, that was one of the things. This is really odd about Kevin's case. He was the first. He was the first death row inmate in California who was allowed to do DNA testing post conviction, and they did this in 2002. And what Kevin wanted tested was this tan T-shirt that the police found, when they found it, they said it only had the blood of the father, Doug Ryan, on it, his blood alone. So Kevin wanted him to test it for maybe like, you know, sweat bands, armpit sweat, or other kinds of, maybe there was other DNA on this shirt that would show it was not him. You know, if it wasn't the father's DNA, it would have to be somebody else's, and if it wasn't Kevin's DNA, then that would exonerate Kevin. So they sent it to an FBI lab in Berkeley, California, and the tests were shocking when they came back. It said that that not only was Doug Ryan's DNA on it, as it was at the beginning, but now Kevin Cooper's blood was on it.
Now, how does that happen?
Here's how it happens. In 2004, we found out that they sent a swab of Kevin's blood off to a lab in Pennsylvania, an independent lab in Pennsylvania, and the scientist there wrote back or faxed back, said, I can't test this swab because it's got the DNA of two people on it, at least two people. Now, this is right from the vial of blood they took from Kevin when he was arrested, like 2 days after he was arrested. So this vial, what that meant was, you know, like they'd taken some of his blood out, probably to use on this tan T-shirt, and then to make it look like they hadn't taken it out, they put somebody else's blood in it. So now we've got this mixed up. We've got at least one other person's DNA besides Kevin's in his own vial of blood.
Unbelievable.
Like if you were a kid, and you drank your father's gin and then you pour water in it to fill it back up, that's what they were doing.
Oh, my.
The crime lab guy, he checked out Kevin's vial of blood for a 24-hour period, shortly before this, when they knew that Kevin was going to be granted the right to have DNA testing. This guy checked it out for 24 hours, took it off premises. And then, lo and behold, now his blood's on the shirt.
Obvious tampering.
Obvious tampering.
Well, we're hoping that the FBI agent that's been assigned will be able to probe more deeply into these issues.
I know. If anybody could, I think an FBI agent is the one to try to do it.
And, of course, careers have moved on. People have retired.
Yeah, they have.
And so tracks, that wasn't exactly the digital age.
No.
In 83 and 85. Computer was in its infancy, and certainly the government, they were keeping hard records that could be easily destroyed or moved around. Now you can't find them.
Yeah.
So it will be a difficult task, no doubt.
Very, very much so. But ORIC is not giving up. They really are committed to seeing Kevin get out of there.
Pat, how is this interview process with Kevin Cooper and coming to grips with the way the police department handled the case and the judicial system, how has this altered or impact your frame of reference?
Well, I used to have the idea that there was always, a few rotten apples in every barrel. But this case really has knocked me off of that. That I feel like you have to have an entirely corrupt police department to pull this off. I mean, the lab has to be corrupt. The detectives have to be corrupt. The DA has to be complicit. It has to be all through the organization. Now, for example, during this whole period that the sheriff was in office, he was in office for 8 years, he was stealing out of the property room. He was taking guns. He took over, he admitted to taking over 550 guns during this eight-year period. And,
wow.
and many of them were illegal guns that should have been destroyed upon receipt. Banned in California, banned in the United States. But he was taking those guns and either keeping them for himself or distributing them to, he had a couple of sons he gave like 15 guns apiece to. They were deputies at the time. And he gave them to other deputies. And then in the head guy in the lab, he was caught right after Cooper's trial. He was fired. It's kind of the timing of this is very suspicious to me. He was caught stealing 5 pounds of heroin out of the property room. And that had a street value of like $350,000. He was not prosecuted. He's now employed by the federal government in Washington State doing something else, but he steals, he's caught red-handed with 5 pounds of heroin. God only knows how many other pounds he stole. And he admitted he sold them. He sold them to drug dealers. He was stealing them, sell the drug dealers to service his own habit. So the head guy in the department, the lab, is as corrupt. The sheriff is as corrupt as you can get. He's now retired, but this was a thoroughly corrupt, a culture of corruption is what I see there.
Well, and that continued for decades, actually. I don't think these fraternities, these brotherhoods, are easily penetrated, what happens, you have strong loyalties. So I'm going to be serving in a career with this individual for the next 25, 30 years.
Yep.
And they're watching my back, and I'm watching their back.
The guy that ran the property room, when this guy's name's Tidwell, when Sheriff Tidwell was, he's now no longer sheriff, he's retired, but his sons are running an illegal bail bonds business, and they're being indicted for using the county jails as a way to further they're paying people in the county jails to make references, you know, so they get bail bonds business. So they pull a raid on these two Tidwell boys, these former deputy sheriffs. And this is when they start. They find all these illegal guns, and they say, "Well, I hope you know where we got those. We got those from our dad, you know, the sheriff." So Tidwell, he had it. You know, I mean, it was just thoroughly bad there.
Pat, before we get away with the program, we're on a very short leash. I want to discover the Ryan son who survived,
right,
and who made reference to the three. Has there ever been a search for those three, and or have they been convicted, arrested for other things, or there's no way of knowing who they are? I guess.
Well, we do think we know who one of them is. The man who left the bloody coveralls at his girlfriend's house. We know who he is. He's still alive. He lives now in Cape May, New Jersey. He was arrested in, you know, let's see, 1978 for murdering a 17-year-old girl, cutting her body up into parts and dumping them in a canal, and her body parts were never found. He admitted to doing that and turned state's evidence against the guy, a gang leader, who said he ordered him to do it. And for turning state's evidence, you know, being a snitch, he got 4.5 years for murdering this young girl and was released from prison just about a year before the Chino Hills murders took place. So here you have a real violent offender, and cops didn't want him, though. They eventually did interview him. It was kind of funny. They brought him in because the girlfriend, after a year had gone by and she'd never heard anything about the coverall she turned in, she went down to the detective's office and said, you know, I've never heard anything about those coveralls I turned in. What's the story? And the homicide detective said, well, I'm sorry to tell you, we threw those away. They don't exist anymore. She said, I can't believe it. She said, you labbed them, didn't you? And she used the term labbed. And he said, no, we didn't lab them. She said, I can't believe it. And you've got to interview my boyfriend, whose name is Lee Furrow. That's the guy's name. So they call Furrow in. And they say, we're interviewing you, and this is right on a tape, right on a total, you know, transcript of the interview. It took 24 minutes or so. It says, we want to clear you of the, we're bringing you in here to clear you of the Cooper murders. The Cooper murders.
Oh, my.
It was beautiful. It was just incredible. And at one point, the lead detective, he says to Furrow, would you be willing to take a lie detector test? He said, oh, sure, I'll take one. And then they talk for like 3 more minutes, and the lead detective says, well, I don't think a lie detector test is going to be necessary. And the other detective in the room says, I agree with you. We don't need to have a lie detector test.
Oh.
They had their man. They had Cooper. You know what I mean? We're here just to clear you of the Cooper murders.
Right.
And they did.
Right.
They cleared him.
Yes. Now, the three had left in the Ryan's automobile, a station wagon.
That's right.
Had been seen at a local bar, and the bartender or others there had detected blood and so forth. Whatever happened to that vehicle? Was it ever discovered?
Yeah, it was. Like 10 days later, it was found in Long Beach, California, which is the total opposite direction from Mexico, where Kevin was, checked into a hotel on the next day at 4:30 in the afternoon. So there was another great sign that Kevin had nothing to do with this, because the station wagon's found 45 miles in the wrong direction. And in it they find, there's blood in three different spots in this car. There's blood on the driver's side. These guys are covered in blood, remember? There's blood on the driver's side, there's blood on the passenger side, and there's blood in the where one person would sit in the back seat. So you've got blood in three different places. And they had cigarette butts. Kevin smoked Cools. They found a Viceroy cigarette butt in his car, you know, that kind of thing. All this stuff excluded Kevin.
And none of it became admissible in court.
Well, the public defender didn't really orchestrate this case the way he could have. For example, the young girl that turned in the coverall, she called up the public defender and said, I just found out the cops have destroyed the coveralls I turned in. I want to tell you about those coveralls. And he thinks, well, she's some kind of a quack. And he said, you call my investigator. He wouldn't even talk to her. And the investigator goes out to see her, and he thinks she's some kind of a nut. And the first question he asks her, he says, have you ever been in a mental institution? Would you start off talking to somebody this way who's trying to help you?
Yeah, I mean, in other words, it's going to come down to, we have no evidence, we have your testimony, are you a nutcase?
Yeah, and then they don't even
because
call her.
If
she's not even on the witness list.
Right, because if I bring you in front of the judge and you testify these things, then they're going to say, well, you're mentally unstable.
Which she wasn't, though. She had no mental history at all.
No, her boyfriend did.
Her boyfriend had a criminal history, you know, terrible one.
Yes, he was mental, and so, well, you must be, because you're running with him. It's just a horrific situation.
It is.
Bad in every respect. Bad in every respect, and the title best represents the case. Scapegoat. The Chino Hills murders and the framing of Kevin Cooper by J. Patrick O'Connor, our guest this hour on Authors First. Thank you so much for being my guest, for sharing your passion, the history, the background that went into writing this fascinating book. And thank you for sharing the details that you experienced with Kevin Cooper and others in his association. Now, do you think that there'll be a follow-through on this at some point in the future? Do you think you'll be compelled to revisit the topic? I'm sure you've unearthed so much to try to cram into a book.
Right. Well, yeah, I do, and that's one of the things I do on Crime Magazine. Like, on the case when I wrote about Mumia Abu-Jamal, I've written in the past 4 or 5 years in, like, five other articles that update his case, you know, that explain, like, his appeal process, which I, at the time I finished the book, had not yet begun. You know, so I have access through Crime Magazine to continue to do that.
Pat, thank you for joining us. Any final remarks or anyone on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to or thank you to?
I'd like to thank you to you because, Tony, you did a great interview. This is one of the best interviews I've had, very thorough, and you know the case very well. The only thing I would like to add is that the book itself, I'd really appreciate it. It's available at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's at all those kind of places, and I hope people will take a look at it and just see how broken our justice system can be in the United States.